Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And boy, what a day here. I mean, I'm getting all these emails from people.
You know, according to the law, Hillary Clinton can't serve as Secretary of State because she voted for a pay raise for that. Now, they've done this a couple of times now. I think this is the third time the Congress gets together and they simply say, okay, the pay is going to go back down to what it was. It's not a big deal. It's not an issue. We're going to continue our conversations of the ongoing disaster of the middle class here throughout our show all day today. In the meantime, though, just to give you an update on some of the things that's going on. And by the way, our toll-free number, 866-303-2270, if you want to call into the show. And France, in fact, interesting story in today's Financial Times about how, you know, France has this, it's unique. It's something that only exists in France. They have a position, I suppose, you know, arguably something like what the Department of Labor should be, but these thing called labor tribunals, the article, the news analysis, French keep faith in labor tribunals. This is about, let's have a strong middle class in France. Norbert Guilmez embodies the abiding faith of the downtrodden in France's Prud'homme, pardon my French, it's a system of elected employment tribunals that is unique in Europe. One of the 200,000 plaintiffs lodging a complaint each year, the former miner is seeking redress for unfair dismissal. And the thing that makes his case different is that he says he was fired in 1948. So it's a little strange. Just a little bit strange. Ah, okay. So anyhow, that's, you know, the French, they're trying to figure this out. 8% of French workers are union members, which is about the same as in the United States. But they annually has 200,000 complaints lodged with this board. So it's more like, you know, a labor department that's accessible to you and me. What a novel idea. What an extraordinary idea. You know, what a fine thing that would be, as it were. Retired generals are encouraging Barack Obama to urge a clean break with the Bush detainee policies. I guess that's not quite news. William Kristol, though, the delusional neocon, cheerleader for the war, the guy who I'm convinced this guy's on Prozac. You know, he's always got a smile on his face as death and destruction is happening around him. This is one of the guys who has so much blood on his hands. Bill Kristol, William Kristol, is singularly, well, collectively, but among a small group of people who are singularly responsible for over 4.5 million people being refugees in Iraq, for hundreds of thousands of women and children being forced into prostitution in that part of the world, literally to survive, for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. This guy has so much blood on his hands, I don't understand how he can wake up in the morning, look himself in the mirror, and not put a gun to his head. I mean, that it is that bad. This is William Kristol. And he's saying, we have won the war in Iraq. Well, yeah. I mean, we won the war on May 1st, 2003, when George Bush got up on the deck of the USS Abraham and said major combat operations are over. You know, you win a war when you've taken down the other guy's government. You've taken down the country. I mean, we knocked them out. They're gone. But the spin continues. The spin continues. And all, you know, all the more the tragedy it is. Karl Rove, by the way, orchestrating the Bush Legacy Project. Just when you thought it could not get any weirder, Stephen Hayes over at the Weekly Standard is laying this out. Heather over at Crooks and Liars, great website, brings it to high view. And this, in some ways, came out of one of ABC's Charlie Gibson's interviews of George Bush. But really what's going on is, here's the quote. This is from the Weekly Standard. There is an ongoing Bush legacy project that's been meeting in the White House, really, with senior advisors Karl Rove and Karen Hughes. So instead of meeting in the White House and saying, you know, what are we going to do about the economy? What are we going to do about the fact that people can't live, people can't make it in America? What are we going to do about the ongoing death of the middle class? Instead, they're sitting around talking about how can we spin, how can we lie about, how can we reinvent the Bush presidency? And this, you know, all the more the tragedy. I mean, this is the mind-boggling tragedy of the whole thing. So, anyhow, pick up a couple of your calls. We have an interesting guest who's going to be dropping by the studio here during right after our next break. Al in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Al, what's up?
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Tom.
What's on your mind?
I'm a recent recently converted uncritical conservative talk radio listener and started listening to you and a couple others, and I'm really thankful for the questions that you've caused me to ask about my assumptions that I'd bought into.
Well, thank you, Al.
Yeah, I just finished reading Unequal Protection and What Would Jefferson Do, and I'm real excited to continue my education process.
I wanted
your opinion on something that I think in part reading your material caused me to begin to question the idea of the assumption of a two-income family being an evil necessity in our lives. And, you know, when you begin to think for just a second about how many familial woes have stemmed from that basic problem, which I have, and most of us, I think, have just assumed, oh, that's just the way things are and the way things have to be.
Yeah, today, for example, right now in the United States, 50% of all children come home to an empty house.
Yeah, it's a travesty, and so much of the things that the right begins to, I mean, what I used to decry as social evils that were just a part of the corruption of our society, and really, in part, largely stem from some of the socioeconomic factors. I'm beginning to believe that hinge on that two-party, two-income necessity. Would you agree with that, Tom? And can you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. Yeah. We have to go back to the original assumptions of why we have an economy. And this is something that, you know, Americans discussed and were knowledgeable about from the founding of this country right up until the Reagan era. And, you know, when we started stripping civics and civil, social studies out of our classes and people became economically stupid because they all started paying attention to Arthur Laffer and idiots like that. And the traditional assumption that we had is that a country has an economy. In other words, we pass laws that give limited immunity to people who, if they incorporate, that give tax advantages to people who incorporate, all sorts of benefits to people who run businesses or start businesses. We do that because there's some social good to us for there to be a vibrant business sector. And that social good is that people can have what historically has been viewed as the American dream, which is the ability to raise your family, put your kids through school, have enough money for retirement, take a vacation every year, have some security in your old age, you know, work a 40-hour week, 50 weeks a year, and you know, you pay your dues, as it were, to society, and society makes sure that your back is covered. And that became unraveled with Reagan when we started entering into this era of social Darwinism. And the result of that is that increasingly, because of this war on the middle class, the war on labor in the United States, and really, if you're reading my books, the book that really talks about this is Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. It lays out step by step how this happened and frankly, what we can do about it. But the structural stuff has been changed. A large part of that was doing away with the unions. A lot of that was, you know, stopping the minimum wage from increasing. A lot of that was deregulating businesses in ways. But the bottom line is, we used to think in the United States, if a business is run in a way that if a business can't be run in such a way that it pays its employees a decent wage so that you can have a single wage earner raise a family, then that business has no right doing business in America. And now the prevailing paradigm is when you run a business, you have to squeeze as much as you can out of your workers so that the stockholders and the CEOs can make as much money as possible. And, you know, we never viewed business that way in the United States up until the last 30 years, the last 26 years.
And in your opinion, that way of doing business is fully sustainable?
It certainly was for over 200 years. It is in most of the rest of the fully developed world. So, yeah, I believe it is, Al. I really do. And I, as I said, I make a strong case for that in that book, Screwed. Thanks a lot for the call. We got to take a break here. Tom Hartman with you. Excuse me. Broadcasting live from New York City from the mothership here, headquarters of Air America. Jennifer Weary is going to be with us, senior fellow at Demos. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed, it's the moment we waited for. We're going to learn what's really going on with this economy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters. Teamster.org, the website. Proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. One piece of all this giant structural puzzle that we have to put together if we're going to have a middle class, because a middle class is not a normal thing. It has to be built. What's normal is what Charles Dickens brilliantly chronicled in the United Kingdom back during the Victorian era. That's what you get with a normal laissez-faire unregulated economy. A whole bunch of poor people, a few rich people, and a very small middle class. It's basically the mercantile class. And to speak to that and what's going on right now, Jennifer Weary is with us. She's a senior fellow at Demos, DEMOS.org, think tank here in New York, and a great organization. I went down there and gave a talk four or five months ago for my book, Cracking the Code, when it came out. Jennifer, so glad to have you in the studio with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. You have put together this recent report, this Demos report, Middle Class on Shaky Ground.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some of the bullet points.
Well, overall, what we found is that even before the most recent events, the last 6 months, that really the majority of the middle class, 3 out of 4 middle class families, are in incredibly dire circumstances. Their financial security just isn't there. It's things like education, assets, and their access to health care, the affordability of their basic expenses, and also their housing costs. So, what we did was we created thresholds for each of those areas to look at how economically secure a family would be. And 3 out of 4 middle class families are so weak in the majority of those areas that they're in danger of slipping out of the middle class.
How do you define the middle class?
For the purposes of this, of our work, the research aspect of it, we looked at a certain income range and, tied that to family size so we didn't get things too skewed.
Right.
So the people that we're talking about were people in the $40,000 to $120,000 range. It's a pretty generous range.
Yeah.
We didn't want to load it towards sort of the lower income end.
Right. Which is already in trouble.
Right.
It has been for a long, long time.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, you get over $100,000, you're even in an area where a lot of people would say, no, that's not the middle class. That's, although... try to find an apartment in downtown San Francisco or Manhattan. But nonetheless, how does this – you say the middle class is over about three-quarters, roughly three-quarters of the middle class is, maybe a more cliched way to say it or an easier way to say it is basically one paycheck away from disaster or
mm-hmm.
the loss of one paycheck or one serious illness away from disaster.
Right, right.
But how does that compare – with the middle class in the United States 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and how does that compare with the middle class in other fully developed countries around the world?
Sure.
Because let's put this in a context.
Sure. To add a bit more of context, we got into this by trying to think about what does it mean to be middle class? And the point we came to is, you know, it's not just having a certain income, although, you know, for the purposes of, like, research, we had to define a certain income range. But it's really not about having a certain income, a certain job. It's a way of life in America. Mm. You know, it's really having a certain level of stability, you know, being able to do things like you mentioned earlier, you know, to the previous caller, being able to retire in comfort, being able to put your kids through school, you know, have some modicum of security, not necessarily, you know, a fancy lifestyle or anything like that, but to really have stability in your life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we looked at the, you know, things like, do people have assets to be able to cover themselves in case some unforeseen crisis happens? Do people have access to health insurance? Do they have the necessary education to find a good job? Can they afford their housing? You know, can they afford their basic expenses?
Right.
And when you look at those things, compare them to 20 years ago, you know, people are in a far more perilous position. Like you said, you know, one of the things we found out is that, you know, one half of middle class families, again, people making $40,000 to $120,000 a month, don't have any assets whatsoever. This is not taking into account home equity. You know,
which increasingly is zero or minus.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you know, and again, I've, you know, when my dad died, his house was fully paid off, and mm-hmm. I think, and you know, he worked in tool and die shop for 40 years. I think that mm-hmm. that was the American dream.
That's
that
right.
was the American norm right. in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
I mean, you work hard, you have stability in your life, you
right.
know, in your economic life and right. your family life as a result.
So,
and
how do we compare now with, you say it's disappearing, how does it compare with how it was, you know, for my dad's generation,
mm-hmm.
Your parents' generation, your grandparents' generation? How does that compare for, other countries, other European countries, Japan, Australia?
You know, I haven't done a lot of research and work into this area, but mm-hmm. the things that I do know is there is more of a social safety net. So, you know, wages are at a certain level, but any sort of lack of stability that wages might bring are offset by access to things like, you know, quality education at an affordable price, or in most cases, you know, even up to university level, free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, employers, between the employers and sort of a government social safety net, people have access to health care. So those kind of two big expenses in the case of health care really being sort of a sudden shock to your system if you can't afford it. Those things are taken care of, and other countries are much more stable in those areas.
Is that to say that if we simply said, okay, if you want health care, I mean, if we were to provide national health care, that would solve the problem? I mean, does that?
See, I don't think so. Part of what we found in what we do, and I think part of what when everybody thinks about their experience, the individual experience, when you think about the experience of Main Street, is it's not just education. It's not just assets. It's not just healthcare. And, you know, we tend to think in either-or dichotomies. Right? We put all our efforts into shoring up one of those areas. But in reality, if we're weak in the others, you know, the instability still is there.
Right. We're talking with Jennifer Weary, W-H-E-A-R-Y. She's a senior fellow at DEMOS, DEMOS.org, think tank here in Manhattan. The new report on the declining middle class. Jennifer, can you stick around a little bit?
Sure.
I want to share with you Teddy Roosevelt's thoughts on this, and maybe we'll take some calls and see where this goes. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire.
Oh, it's our Christmas music.
Hot sauce dripping from their toes.
Although the chipmunks aren't all that happy about it.
Yuletide squirrels, fresh filleted by the choir. They poked hot skewers through their nose.
Ouch!
Everybody knows. Some pepper and a garlic clove help to make them seasoned right. Tiny rats with a crisp golden coat will really hit the spot tonight.
Oh, yeah, it's the season, isn't it?
And now when Santa sees his train.
Oh, he's going to be excited.
There'll be some homemade chipmunk jerky for his sleigh.
Okay, enough already. We've hit our Christmas music threshold. I'm sorry, say that again, Jennifer.
I'll ever hear that song the same way again.
Yes. chipmunks roasting on the, what a beautiful voice. In any case, Jennifer Weir is with us. She is a senior fellow at DEMOS, D-E-M-O-S, .org, the think tank here in New York City. We're talking about the fate of the middle class. Jennifer, I want to share with you a speech that Teddy Roosevelt gave. This was personally recorded by Thomas Edison. So, and on wax. So it's not, you know, the very best audio quality, but I'm going to break it into pieces. This was, and the whole thing only runs 35 seconds, but we're going to listen to it in little pieces anyway. This was how it was understood that wealth was created and shared in the United States at the turn, 100 years ago, literally 100 years. I mean, this is literally 100 years old. And first of all, he points out that wealth is created by manufacturing. We don't have real wealth until people make things. If it's just, I'll wash your car, you mow my lawn, that's moving money around, that's not creating wealth. If it's just banking, that's not creating wealth. If it's the financial services industry, it's not creating wealth. But converting some cotton into clothing, that's creating wealth. Converting iron ore into cars, that's creating wealth. And a lot of that's gone. So anyhow, he talks about the necessity of industrial occupation, and then how do we pay people who are creating that wealth? And here is the President of the United States, Republican President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt.
We stand for a living wage.
We stand for a living wage, first of all, he said. This is the first time that word was used in the United States.
Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
So if you work in industry and your wages are subnormal, it's, you can't live. And then he gets into the details. First of all, he says it'll vary from place to place around the country. You can't necessarily have an absolute national standard.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
Okay, so what's a normal standard of living? It must include enough to secure the normal standard of living. This is what, for 100 years, up until Reagan came into office, Americans understood to be the basis of the American dream. What is it? Here, the President of the United States, 100 years ago, the Republican President Teddy Roosevelt tells us.
A standard high enough to make morality possible.
Morality possible. In other words, you don't have to shoplift. You don't have to eat dog food.
To provide for education and recreation.
To put your kids through school and to take a vacation every year.
Care for immature members of the family.
To raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
So you've got health care and it's totally covered.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to retire with safety and security. Now, I can't think of anything, frankly, to add to that list.
I absolutely agree. I think what's most interesting about that, I mean, there's so many interesting things, but one of the most telling things about that is that, now, again, this idea of a middle-class standard of living, a reasonable standard of living, it's in the DNA of our country.
Yeah.
This is, like you said, this is 10 decades that we've been pursuing this.
It's really 23. I mean, among the founders, the people who signed the Declaration of Independence and the people who signed the Constitution, none of them in today's dollars was a millionaire. Mm-hmm. Some of them were land rich, but none of them left dynasties. Mm-hmm. None of them left family fortunes. The first person to actually have, in today's dollars, $1 million was in 1791.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There were, quite a few very, very wealthy people in this country at the time of the Revolutionary War. They left. Mm-hmm. They went to Canada and the UK. Pardon my interrupting.
That's quite right. I think something else that we can learn from this is that, sort of establishing this idea of a reasonable standard of living early on in the nation's history as a goal. Then throughout the 20th century, really being something being pursued. You can almost see like go an arc, right? Mm-hmm. So if 50s, 60s, really sort of hits its heyday. And then the 70s starts to decline in terms of, being available to people.
Yeah.
And again, this most recent downturn just really brings into stark relief how ill-prepared the middle class, the so-called middle class, is to weather things. So if one of the tenets of being middle class, of having this middle class stability, is being able to weather unforeseen crises. We have not necessarily an unforeseen, but an incredible and avoidable crisis now. And what we're going to see is more instances of sort of the effect of not having that stability. Again, this is the middle class. This is the largest group of Americans.
Yeah, and we're already seeing it. In fact, if we were to calculate unemployment the same way we did the year Bill Clinton came into office, our unemployment rate would be around 11% right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have funny numbers,
right.
All up and down. And then we got Henry Paulson between him and Bernanke and these guarantees that the Fed is making on top of the Treasury's department. We're talking over $7 trillion. That's half the GDP of the entire country. I mean, what are they doing to our currency? Where is this money going? And why are we not taking care of the middle class in America? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Do you have any insights into that, Jennifer?
I don't have any insights into why, because for me it's unfathomable. I think for many people, especially the sort of, you know, the millions of us in the middle class, you know, we don't get it.
I think it's Warren Buffett's, you know, he said there really is a class war and my class is winning. Mm-hmm. I think he was right that there are predators out there. I would submit to you that they have that they're mentally ill, that they have OCD and their obsession of their OCD focuses on money, mm-hmm. that there's never enough for them. They always have to have more and more and more. And it's literally a mental illness. Native Americans used to call it wetiko. You know, the potlatch societies really got it. Giving mm-hmm. away is the best way to achieve status.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Phil Grahams of the world are you know, robbing, raping, and pillaging our economy.
Well, I think what you said earlier about, you know, the onset of economic Darwinism, you know, I think, you know, we can sort of go through a more elaborate explanation, but I almost think that part of what's happening is sort of an increasing set of assumptions that it doesn't matter if you know, others are behind as long as I get ahead.
Right.
And that sort of that competitive mentality being a natural outgrowth of not being able to get ahead.
Yeah.
You know, we do have an elite class, you know, but that's a small percentage of Americans. For the most of us, though, you know, there was this constant pressure. I know, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, we didn't have a lot in my family. And so in my sort of mindset, I knew that I had to get enough to get by, not only to get by, but, you know, to be able to sort of get myself out of that insecurity that my family was experiencing. And so as you get into working and you know, sort of have the opportunity maybe to do that or don't, you know, weighs on your mind. And so you become increasingly competitive and you think about yourself, because, you know, that self-preservation is a real result of, you know, sort of having that self having been threatened.
But at the end of the day, the big cleavage, I think, between the libertarian and conservative worldview and the traditional American worldview, George Washington called himself a liberal. I mean, our country was founded in the liberal enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
The traditional American worldview is that traditionally Americans have viewed our nation as a we society.
Mm-hmm.
We're about we. And the conservatives and the libertarians view us as a me society. You know, I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. I mean, you know, it's, economically, they're indistinguishable from Grover Norquist.
Mm-hmm.
That fundamental debate about whether we're a we society or a me society arguably goes back to the election of 1800 and the debates between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's always been with us, and we've cycled back and forth numerous times between the we and the me being ascendant in our society. And I think we're right at the cusp right now. This is the good news out of this. I mean, here's the headline in today's Financial Times: "The worst is yet to come." Literally right up at the top underneath where it says Financial Times, before you even get to any of the stories, it says "the worst is yet to come" in bright red letters. 2009 will be a painful year of global recession, deflation, and bankruptcies. You know, referring to an article on page 13 by Noriel Robini, who's a brilliant observer and very, very thoughtful commentator on these things. But the silver lining in that is that it could be the thing, it could be the catalyst that I believe it is already, not that it will be. I think that we're already there. The catalyst that is going to cause the average American to reject Reaganomics, mm-hmm. to reject Reaganism, to reject the me, mine, you know, I'm going to get mine, all that kind of stuff, and say, no, we are a we society. And maybe we should look at some of the we societies around the world. In Denmark, if you're unemployed 2.5 years, two and a half years, you get unemployment insurance. And when that runs out, there are social services available to you. No matter how old you are, no matter whether or not you're employed, no matter what, you get free health care. There's aid to housing. There's a national industrial policy. And it's not just Denmark. I mean, I just happen to know that because we did our show from there in June, and we spent a whole week talking with Danish politicians about how they put together the society. And in America, people go, oh, my God, that's socialism, because they refer to themselves as democratic socialists, like Bernie Sanders does.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to say, you know, damn it, we need some more democratic socialists in this country. Your thoughts, Jennifer?
I think one of the, as you were saying, one of the outgrowths of this is, you know, we have no choice but to rebuild. because, you know, sort of economic security has gone down. When you get to rebuild, you get to also rethink the way things should be. And so I think it is an opportunity.
It really is. Let's pick up some phone calls. Great. After the break, Jennifer is in the studio with us. Jennifer Weary of Demos, DEMOS.org. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. We'll pick up your calls, 866-303-2270. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. You can pick up our live video stream over at AirAmerica.com, or there's a button at TomHartman.com. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights, stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. Yeah, I got friends with low wages. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. 'Cause the union's missing.
See, that's what we need to change. This is structural stuff. It's not that Walmart is an evil company. I mean, you can argue that they've engaged in some evil practices over the years. But by and large, they're a bunch of business people doing what business people do, which is playing by the rules. The problem is we need to change the frigging rules. I mean, in India, it is a felony for a company to own more than two retail stores. That's why in the entire country of India, there is one Walmart. Can you imagine? And they do that. 97% of the entire retail sector in Walmart is owned by single families, not a single family, individual family. Can you imagine in the United States if we did that? It's like the Sherman Act on steroids. Jennifer Weary is with us. Weary is with us with Demos.org. Jennifer, any quick thoughts on that rant, and then we'll pick up some phone calls?
I just want to comment on the song. I actually found it strangely more uplifting than the Christmas Chipmunk song.
There you go. We are noted for our eclectic bumper music, which is the hard work, actually, of my wife, Louise, who helps produce the program and does a marvelous job with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dave in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Dave. What's up?
Thanks, Tom. Jennifer, I'm a social democrat. France has a uniqueness that we can bring home. Their GDP is the only country of significance that has a GDP that is up. And they also have the finest in the world as far as health care. And so the finest health care in the world provided by the government has not crimped their GDP.
Right.
So our country can move forward with national health care.
Amen.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you. Very well said. It's, you know, we used to think in terms of investments, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to realize that if, for example, the reason the University of California used to be free before Ronald Reagan became governor was everybody in California understood it was a big enough state. Most people would stay there. If you put $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, which is what it cost for college education back in the 60s, into a person, you'd make back $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 over the course of their life in taxes,
mm-hmm.
in increased taxes, that education is an investment. We used to think of healthcare as an investment. We used to think of all of these things as an investment, even roads, bridges. Now, because of 26, 28 years of insane conservative economic policies, we think of these things as expenses. How do we recalibrate the American perception of this?
Well, as we were saying, right before we went to the last break, we have no choice now but to rebuild a system that's broken. And in doing that, we need to rethink the role of government.
Hmm.
And you know, it's not as though we aren't, investing dollars anyway. That the role of the government, is in part to do that. It's just as we were saying earlier. I think that there's hope that in our rethinking, we'll get it a little more right this time.
I have tremendous hope. And in particular, because we're not the first to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, first of all, it's not the first time it's been done in the United States.
That's right.
And secondly, it's been done in a lot of countries around the world a whole lot better. And as our caller just pointed out, well said. Adam in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for such a good show. I learned lots of stuff from you.
Thank you.
I'm actually on the long road to Medford right now. I hope my phone sounds all right.
Oh, it sounds fine. What's your question or point?
I want to talk about what you said about the Reaganomics. People are waking up to, see that it's not all it's cracked up to be. But I kind of wanted to get some advice, maybe. I mean, some people are just so hung up on the, government taking your money and the handout. They paint the liberals as giving handouts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my grandmother tells stories about growing up after the Depression and how great Roosevelt was, and she would never say welfare. They were on public assistance, but mm-hmm. yet she votes Republican in every election.
Right.
I mean, how do we, really convince people that, especially, with how the media is and...
Yeah. I think, frankly, I get it, Adam, and thanks for the call. I think the way that you do it is you address it head on. When somebody says something like that, you say, oh, yeah, there are a lot of socialist programs in the United States. Maybe we should do away with them. Let's do away with our socialist public roads. Let's do away with our socialist police departments. Let's do away with our socialist fire departments. Let's do away with our socialized free clean air that we have. Let's do away in many communities in the United States with the socialized low cost high quality water supply or electric supply. Let's do away with the socialized military. Let's do away with the socialized USDA that makes sure our food is safe. And let's do away with the socialized FDA that makes sure our drugs are pure. Is that what you're talking about? And at that point they go, any other suggestions, Jennifer, here?
I think that's a sort of really hard-fisted argument, but I think that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
They
have to realize that when they're listening to this anti-government rhetoric, what they're really listening to is BS. It's nonsense. It's just absolute nonsense. Steve in Milpitas, California. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. Steve, we have a minute before we got to wrap up this hour.
Right. I'll keep it short. Look, I'm looking at this economic meltdown as a real opportunity for us to kind of break the trance that we've had about stuff and start to put our attention back on each other and help each other out. I think that's going to be actually a wonderful opportunity for us as Americans.
Amen. And I think it's happening, Steve. Jennifer, your thoughts?
I think if there's anything good that can come out of this, that's it. And I love the idea of breaking the trance that we've been in. That's just a great way to put it. That's exactly what's happened.
Yeah. The trance, for example, that... if you increase taxes, you slow down the economy. Well, wait a minute. During the period of time when we had 91% top marginal tax rate from 1936 until 1980, mm-hmm. we had the strongest industrial growth in America. Why? Because rich people, when they were looking at all that extra income, said, instead of putting that money in my pocket and paying 90% of it in taxes, I'm going to reinvest it in factory equipment. I mean, this is not rocket science, my
exactly.
friends.
Plenty of good lessons from the past.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Jennifer Weary is with us, or has been with us. Thank you so much. With Demos, DEMOS.org, the website here in New York. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you on. Stick around. We'll be right back. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the conventional wisdom, as such, the frankly insane conventional wisdom, is that if you raise taxes, you slow down an economy. All of us have memorized this because ever since Ronald Reagan came into office, with that whack job, Mr. Laffer, at his side, and David Stockman and Grover Norquist and the whole Star of the Beast crowd and the Destroy Government crowd and the Hate Democracy, Small D Democracy crowd, they have been promoting this mantra that somehow, if the rich among us have their taxes raised, then they will no longer be interested in paying your or my paychecks. And the old cliche, I never saw a poor man give somebody a job. Well, first of all, it's a lie. Most jobs are created in the United States by small businesses, and most businesses are started by people in the middle class. But nonetheless, that's the conventional wisdom. How do we push back on that? Larry Beinhart wrote Wag the Dog, The Librarian, The Fog Facts, Searching for Truth in the Land of Spin, a new novel, Salvation Boulevard. His website is Larry Beinhart, BEINHART.com. He's written some brilliant stuff, but to this topic, some of the most important, in my opinion, brilliant work that Larry Beinhart has ever done has been recently published on alternet.org, The Myth of Tax Cuts Stimulating the Economy, etc. Larry, I'm so grateful you can come on our show. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Tom. It's really a pleasure.
I have been flogging your work for weeks now.
Thank you.
You have nailed it. And I'm curious, first of all, you know, a lot of us go back to original sources. For example, I'm right now working on a work that's trying to synthesize Alexander Hamilton's industrial policy, Frederick List's notion that free trade is the most stupid thing a country can engage in, and you know, in 1848, and today's policies.
I assume you're going to do interviews.
Yeah, actually, I mean, they wrote so eloquently about it, and it reads quite well actually today. That I'm just weaving these things together, but you know, what was your starting point on this? So, you know, other than common sense, I have not seen any good, or maybe I'm just missing them, any good commentaries that have so succinctly and tightly pulled together the fact that when you raise taxes on the rich, you stimulate the economy, as what you've written.
Well, I was listening to all these guys during the campaign. And everybody says, oh, we have to have tax cuts to stimulate the economy.
Yeah, even Democrats are saying that.
Everybody was saying it. It's a universal mantra. And we had just had it happen right before our eyes. George Bush cut taxes. The economy went into the tank. So he cut taxes some more. It certainly didn't recover in a healthy way. And then it crashed. So I'm looking at this series of two tax cuts not doing what was claimed. So I decided to take a look at the economy and tax cuts. No, I didn't find it anywhere else, which bothered me. I mean, a lot of these things that I find, I kind of say, well, how come this is not the common wisdom instead of what? Anyway, so I took a look, and what I found some really interesting patterns. I think the most interesting one is we've had basically three big crashes since we've instituted the tax, income tax. Income tax was instituted by constitutional amendment in 1913, and we used it to finance the First World War.
Although it was used during Lincoln's time, by the way.
It was, but it was...
That was a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah, but it was judged unconstitutional.
Yeah.
And so they passed a constitutional amendment so they could do it. So basically, if you're talking about income taxes, you're talking about 1913 to the present.
Right.
Okay. So after the war, starting about in the 20s, they started the taxes were up around 77% or 70% for the richest people. And we're only talking about top marginal rates here.
Right. This is we're people who are earning over...
How much taxes you tax plumbers and teachers.
Right.
Top marginal tax rates around 70%. There's no war going on. They decide to cut taxes. And you immediately have this pattern ensues. You get a boom. The boom turns into a bubble. And then you get the crash of 29. And the crash is accompanied by massive bank failures. And it's accompanied by, in those days, a depression.
Right.
Okay?
So it looks like in the teens and 20s, the high taxes on the rich acted as a stabilizer, as ballast for the ship of state, as it were.
Well, let's just, you know, it acts as a lot of things. And, you know, first let's deal with facts, and then let's move on to theory. The facts are there were tax cuts, boom, bubble, crash, bank failures, depression.
Right.
Then we get next really big tax cut is under Reagan. And And Reagan actually has a series of tax cuts. He takes taxes down from 70% first to 50, and then he cuts them down to 38.5. Then in 1987, there's another crash, and it was called at the time the worst since 1929. It was called Black Monday. A lot of the bubble that had been created after the tax cuts was, surprise, in real estate. And there were bank failures, more bank failures than in the Great Depression. It was called the savings and loan crisis, and there had to be a massive bailout.
Right.
Okay? Then along comes George Bush the second. Taxes were already pretty low. Top marginal rate was 39% under Clinton, and he took it down to 35%. And then he took, then he added additional tax cuts, on capital gains, which is unearned income, and on inheritance taxes. And, basically we had the same pattern. We had a big bubble. A lot of it was in real estate, and we had a crash. And crashes accompanied by massive bank failures, and depending on what we do subsequently, it will be accompanied by either a recession or an actual depression.
Right.
Okay. Now, here's the really weird part. The four greatest periods of growth in modern U.S. economic history, World War II is number one, of course, 1941 to 45. Top tax rate varied between 80 and 94%. Second period is post-war under Truman Eisenhower. Top rate bounced around between 81 and 92%. Then we have the Clinton years. When Clinton came in, there was a top marginal tax rate of 31%. He kicks it up to 37 and then 39. And we have healthy economic growth. The Roosevelt administration's the New Deal is very controversial. There's a major industry, an entire major industry dedicated to proving the New Deal didn't work.
Right. All you have to do is Google Great Depression or something. The first 1,000 hits are right-wing talking points.
Right. However, so we're talking about the period 1933 to 1940. Over that period, all told, the economy grew 58%.
Right.
Even though there was a secondary recession in the middle of it.
In 37. Yeah.
Right? And here's a really interesting point. Because, you know, when you read the right-wing stuff, they do deal with actual statistics. It's just how they spin them. And here's the interesting concept. Okay. The right-wing says the New Deal didn't work, that it was World War II that finally pulled the United States out of the Great Depression. In an economic sense, what was World War II? World War II was the New Deal in quintuplicate.
Sure.
Okay?
It was a massive public works program.
Massive public works, massive public employment. Of course, it wasn't the kind of job you might like because you were likely to die because of it.
You could argue that spending.
And it was very high taxes.
Yeah, and you could argue that after the war was over, the World War II actually slowed down our recovery because so much of our national wealth had been turned into bombs and dropped on Germany and Japan.
Yeah, well, the World War II was hugely profitable for the United States. I mean, it was a great investment. We emerged from World War II
as the only industrial economy left standing. Larry, can you stick around?
Yep.
We're going to take a break here. We're talking with Larry Beinhart. Larry Beinhart, BEINHART.com is his website. The author of some just brilliant pieces recently over at alternet.org. Stick around. We'll be right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Through, I've been trying.
Yep, we need to wake up America. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Beinhart on the line. He's the author of numerous brilliant books, Wag the Dog, The Librarian, Fog Facts, his new novel, Salvation Boulevard. Larry Beinhart, BEINHART.com, his website, his newest articles, a series of a couple of articles about tax cuts, the BS and the facts, over at alternet.org. A number of people over the last week or two that I've been pointing people to and quoting your articles, Larry, have been saying,
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Where
can I find this stuff? And so I wanted to get you on and just lay it out. So let's just summarize this thing in the few minutes that we have left here. That number one, tax increases on the rich. Tax increases on the rich lead to sustained and prolonged and healthy growth in the economy. Tax cuts on the rich lead to bubble economies, crashes, and you could even argue to wars, because they very often come out of crashes. And first of all, is my summary competent so far?
It's competent. I can't say that it leads to wars, okay?
Yeah, I tossed that in.
Yeah.
But World War II, well, who knows? Anyway, it leads to bubbles and bursts. And
it's each major tax cut has been followed by a bubble, a crash, bank failures, and either a recession or a depression.
Right. And going all the way back to 1913.
Right. And if, by the way, if anybody has managed to keep any cash out of this last market crash, all the recoveries can be marked from the time a tax increase on the top tax rates have been instituted.
So the minute the Democrats raise taxes, start buying stocks.
I'm not a stock analyst. I'm just telling you that historically, if you look back, the point you'll see a tax increase, and shortly thereafter, whether it's a few months or a year, that marks the point where.
Well, similarly, if you just look at the last 100 years at Republican versus Democratic administrations and the growth of the Dow. You see that under Democratic administrations it does well, and under Republican administrations
right.
It does poorly. Now we know why.
Absolutely one of the reasons, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious, Larry, first of all, you're suggesting if we want to stimulate the economy, if we want to rebuild our economy, raise taxes on the rich, number one. Number two, do you have examples from other countries where you've seen these same kinds of cycles or you can demonstrate this same mechanism?
You know, I didn't look at other countries. I looked at the U.S. situation. Mm. But clearly, some ideas are obvious enough that now kind of everybody's talking about them.
I think you have the foundation of a best-selling book here, Larry. I'm telling you. I'm serious.
Clearly one of the ideas is you invest in infrastructure.
Yeah.
And one of the things about infrastructure that nobody talks about is that it is an invisible subsidy to all business.
Yes.
That is to say, it makes doing any other business cheaper if you can get things distributed, if you can communicate more easily and more safely and more quickly. Even things like, rebuilding the inner city or working on a criminal justice system or finding alternatives to incarceration.
Yeah.
Make doing business cheaper.
Let me toss a couple of quickies at you here. Number one, if we want to save the country, roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
I expect, the numbers here.
I mean, forget the Clinton tax cuts. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
The numbers are actually pretty scary. I mean, when I start, when I tell people, when were the times of biggest growth, everybody accepts that it was World War II and Truman Eisenhower. Okay, no problem. And then I point out that the top tax rate was in the 90% range. And that sounds strange and bizarre. And, I find myself saying, oh, my God, what if I end up making some money? I don't want to be taxed at 90%. But even smaller numbers, when we went from 31% under Bush 1 to 37 and then 39.5% under Clinton, that
started a major improvement in the economy.
Right.
Okay. It became a bubble. Again, thanks to information from the Heritage Institution, I think it was Heritage, might have been American Enterprise, who, you know, desperately didn't want Clinton to have credit for anything, pointed out that there was a tax cut after the tax raise because there was a tax cut on capital gains that the Republican Congress pushed through.
Right, and you would submit that that actually created the bubble.
That marks, that explicitly marks the point where the boom, which is reasonably healthy, turns into a bubble, becomes the dot-com bubble that becomes the crash.
Right.
Okay? So taxes has to be targeted. Taxes on high incomes lead to saner kinds of investments.
Yep.
And does that tone mean that we got to get off?
Yeah, it is. We're out of time. It's the tyranny of the clock. But, Larry, thanks so much.
A pleasure. I'll be happy to come back anytime you like.
We'll do it again. Larry Beinhart, BEINHART.com, his website. Larry, you're doing some brilliant writing here, and I hope you turn this thing into a book fast.
Okay.
Keep it up.
Thanks a lot.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Yep, it's the new revolution. That's what we're working on, my friends. I'm telling you, it's like childbirth. I've watched my three children be born. In fact, I caught two of the three of them. I used to say I delivered them, and then Louise pointed out to me that, no, she delivered them. I caught them. There's a big difference. But anyhow, the point is that this wonderful thing of bringing a new life into the world involves some pain. And the wonderful thing of creating a truly new economy, something frankly I don't think could have been done without the kind of crisis and pain that we're experiencing right now. We are experiencing the birth pains. Right now we're experiencing the labor pains. We have not yet gotten to the screaming, oh my God, here it comes, push, push. But frankly, I don't think it's going to take that long. I don't think it's going to be that long. And what will come out of that is a new economy, a new United States. I am absolutely and totally optimistic about this. And I think the main thing, somebody called the other day and said, you know, what should we do about investments, things like this? I think my personal take on this, and I'm not an investment advisor, and have not been particularly brilliant as an investor throughout my life. I've done very well as a small businessman, but every time I've tried to play the markets, it's bit me in the butt. But I think that the wise strategy right now, as Larry just pointed out, is stay heavy in cash or cash instruments, commodities, and then when the Democrats start raising taxes on the rich, which will strengthen the economy, let's get back to that. Then the market will start coming back, and then there will be time for people to get into investments. But for a while, we're going to all have to hold on to our breath. Speaking of holding on to your breath, our Jaws alert for the day. This is bizarre. A new study by the University of Arizona microbiology professor Chuck Gerba, the germ doctor. He went through a patient's hospital rooms and he said, okay, what part of the hospital room is the absolute creepiest in terms of things like fecal bacteria, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA, MRSA, you know, these nasty bugs that can literally eat your arm off or cause god-awful, gut symptoms. What is the dirtiest part of a hospital room? It was not the toilet bowl. It was not the handle on the toilet. It was not the door into the bathroom. It was not the door into the room. It was not the buzzer that you push to call the nurse. It was, believe it or not, the TV remote control. Think about it. How often have you ever seen a TV remote control scrubbed down with alcohol or something? And nobody ever cleans these things. Everybody comes in, has to grab the thing and change the channel, mute it while they're talking. They are absolutely filthy. They're germ vectors. It's just like that study that we shared with you 6-8 months ago. The other dirtiest thing that you can find in an office is the keyboard on the computers. Keyboard computers are absolutely filthy. They're laced with everything from fecal bacteria to flu viruses. So, you know, not that I'm trying to create a nation of OCD Tom Hartman program listeners, but time to get out the alcohol swabs. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Tim in Detroit, listening on WDTW. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Well, you're talking about cleaning up the economy, so to speak.
Yeah, there you go. Great segue.
Would you say that a big part of the solution to revivify the middle class would be to really get out of the WTO, reinstitute, reasonable trade barriers, and obviously, re-regulate back at home?
Yes, absolutely. Excellent question, Tim. Thank you very much for asking it. Here's the way to frame it, in fact, in an argument with a conservative. Conservatives for years and years and years have said, we hate the United Nations because the United Nations is a surrender of sovereignty. You know, the Constitution of the United States says that when we sign a treaty, that treaty becomes the law of the land. And it's true. It's in the Constitution. So if we signed a treaty with Mexico that said that it was illegal to use the word Mexican in a derogatory form, and you were to do so, if you were to say, look at that Mexican and use some kind of nasty tone of voice, you could go to jail if we signed that treaty because it would supersede all the laws. You know, it's a lousy example, but you get the point. So we have, and so when we created the UN, we signed these treaties that brought the UN into being. And all these conservatives, they're all hysterical about the fact that some of our laws actually got changed. It's against the law now because of the UN treaties. It's against the law for the United States to unilaterally declare war on another country. We can't do it because the UN was created to form world peace. And this has the conservatives got their panties all in a while. They're all hysterical about it. So all you have to do is point out to them that the World Trade Organization, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades and NAFTA and many of the other many times they call them agreements to try and get around that treaty thing. But really, at their core, they're treaties, and some of them are explicitly called treaties. What these things are surrender. We are surrendering our national sovereignty, and we're not surrendering it to a world body of nations who are working for peace. We're surrendering it to about 100 transnational corporations. 51 of the largest 100 economies in the world are corporations, not countries. And those are the people who control the World Trade Organization. And so, yeah, if you want sovereignty back, get rid of the WTO. Patrick in Chicago. Hey, Patrick.
Good afternoon, Tom. I've been hearing you for quite a while, and I've been wondering. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, yeah. And I've been wondering, you talk about the structure, the law, the administration, but you don't seem to talk about what the attitude of the corporate owner are, and that is they just do not like labor.
Mm.
They think of labor as something to be, minimized.
Well, back in the 19th century, they used to shoot people. I mean, Joe Hill was put in front of a firing squad. Look at the Pullman Porter strikes. Look at the Haymarket Square riots. I mean, you're right. There's a long history of labor being dissed by management.
Well, I feel that if you look at Walmart, absolutely hate labor union, and what all the effort they go through to stop labor union, it's because the founder of Walmart came from Arkansas. And I just feel that so many of the corporate owner really feel labor just one step above or one step beside slavery.
Mm, yeah. Slavery was the ultimate cheap labor. And you know, thank God we got rid of that. But I think your slavery metaphor is probably somewhat apropos. Here's the and thanks for raising it, Patrick. And here's the other thing. With a publicly traded corporation, there is no owner. There are stockholders. There are not owners. With a privately held corporation, you have an owner. You know, I have a small business. It's called my radio show. I own that business. Louise and I own that business. And if my corporate taxes were real high at the end of the year, instead of paying myself whatever money might be left in the bank, I would have a very strong incentive to roll that money into new investments. Let's buy some new equipment. Let's, do something great for the show. Let's do the show from some other part of the world and prepay it, you know, whatever. Try to get the tax rather than just sticking it in your pocket. But the bottom line is that an owner has an investment in the company. An owner wants to see the company grow. I want to see my show grow. A stockholder doesn't give a damn about that stuff. A stockholder wants to see a dividend paid and wants to see the value of the stock go up. Stockholders are essentially gamblers. Owners are the backbone of American business. And when we changed the rules in the 1980s about how CEOs are compensated, and we stopped paying them paychecks, and we started paying them with stock options, we moved them out of the category of management that was concerned about the future of the business and interpenetrated with the business. You know, keep in mind, in the 1950s, about 40% of all CEOs had been with the company 40 years. Not the case anymore. We move from that to CEOs and senior executives in big corporations behaving as if they were stockholders, in other words, simply trying to maximize benefit for the next quarter or the next two quarters. And that's why corporate America, one of the main reasons why corporate America is so terribly, terribly dysfunctional. Stan in Jacksonville, Florida, listening to WZNZ. We've got about a minute here before the break, Stan. What's up?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air, Stan.
Okay, this is Stan in Jacksonville.
Yep.
Just quickly enough, I wanted to share with you maybe a headline story that will be national. I have a working background in health insurance, major medical insurance. I used to sell the stuff, so I'm the informed consumer. I just discovered in the last 2 days that, and I've not heard this anywhere else, PPOs are becoming HMOs. Behind the scenes, with no notice, with no formal structure about appeals and everything else, PPOs, Preferred Provider Organization programs, are screening people prior approval. I now know one HMO working, one PPO network, not local Blue Cross, working here in Florida that will only pay one MRI a year. Hmm. So what you have is a totally unregulated environment. And it's a situation which is making the HMO model, where you know you have pre-approvals and all that, bad. It's suddenly become a national thing in 2 years, I discovered.
Wow. Well, thanks for the heads up on that, Stan. I'll keep my eyes open.
Maybe get some other callers to follow up on that, yeah.
Yeah, I'll keep my eyes open on it. And if you get any good links or any stories on it, send them to me over at tomhartman.com. I'll track it down. We just need to get a single-payer national health care program tomorrow. That's the solution.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com is on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today? What's going on in Washington, D.C. in particular?
Well, White House Press Secretary Dana Perino asked whether the White House was on the same page as Speaker Pelosi, who has said that bankruptcy for the automakers is not an option, said in response to that, well, she wouldn't exactly respond to that, but she is saying that that a path has been laid out, and basically they want to see if the companies are viable, and that's the key word that the White House is using, viability, and that they're looking at the summaries of the plans, and they want to move forward on that, and she won't speculate beyond that, but she's very keen to look at the plans at this point, and that's where they are.
At the end of the day, Victoria, is there going to be a battle between the White House, I mean, you know, Bush has to sign off on this thing, and Republicans in the House or Senate versus the Democrats who, I think broadly, we can all agree, want the big three automakers to survive?
I think that's a possibility, because I think what you're also going to have is a possible standoff between lame ducks and non-lame ducks. You've got people who are conscious of the fact that they're going home to their constituency shortly, and people who are not getting bailouts are going to be looking at the automakers who are about to get a bailout. And a lot of people, both on the left and on the right, don't feel that the automakers deserve a bailout. And if they're going to get one, there are lawmakers who are going to have to face down their own constituents. So I think it's more, even more complex than left versus right.
Yeah, interesting. Although when you think of it, I mean, you know, Hank Paulson has handed out over $300 billion, and I can't tell you where any of it went. I don't think anybody knows. There's been no oversight. And we're talking about here, what, GM wants $18 billion or something like that? I mean, we're talking chump change compared to what has already been passed out.
Well, she was asked about that as well today, about the GAO report, and her reply to that was that the report summarizes Treasury's progress in implementing TARP, and she said that basically that it was important to remember that the report was drafted before 60 days had even passed since the legislation made it through Congress, and she says basically that Treasury had actually agreed with most of the recommendations in the report and has been implementing them, and they will continue to do so. So the way they're reading it is that basically Treasury's completely on board with everything that DAO said.
You think so?
Well, that's what the White House is saying, but that's certainly not the way that the GAO is portraying it.
Right. It seems like Dana Perino, once again, has entered her own reality, her own little twilight zone.
It's certainly seeing it very differently from the way the GAO would be seeing it.
Right, and the rest of us, Mel Martinez has said that he's not going to, the senator from Florida who's up for re-election in 2010, is the Republican, has said he's not going to run for re-election, that he wants to spend more time with his family. The buzz is that somebody from the Bush family came to him and said, Mel, if you want to live a few more years, you're going to make way for Jeb.
Yes, you're going to get a horse's head on your pillow.
Yes, exactly. And I'm wondering if you're hearing that same kind of buzz within Republican circles that I'm hearing as gossip in Democratic circles, that Martinez was actually pushed out of the way by the Bush family to make way for Jeb, A, and B, whether or not that's the case, how we can expect a lame duck, because now he's got 2 years of quackitude, a lame duck Mel Martinez to behave in the Senate. Is he going to become more obstructionist, or is he going to become more friendly with the Democratic power structure?
On the second one, I don't know which way he's going to jump. I don't know. But one thing I did hear earlier today was that he has a tendency to lean moderate and that he might jump that way. So, which is interesting. The rumor, and I haven't been tightly wound into the rumor mill, but the rumor is that there were some horses' heads that were promised.
In other words, he was threatened out of the job rather than enticed out of the job.
Well,
perhaps a bit of both.
Yeah, there were friendly horses' heads.
Yeah, interesting. So.
And that it would be a bit of a romp for Jeb Bush. This is not going to be a difficult election to win.
Yeah, you're right. You know, Jeb Bush is very popular down in Florida. And in fact, he was term limited out, as I recall. Was he not?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, the Bush dynasty just keeps on ticking. And then he, who is George the Third? George Bush the Third?
I don't know.
He's somebody's. He's either Marvin or he's not Jeb's son. But there's been talk about him. I guess he's in his 20s or 30s.
There's another generation coming?
Yep. Yep.
Really?
So now Bill Richardson's moving off to the Commerce Department, and
he's beardless. I'm disappointed that he got rid of that beard. It was quite good.
Well, that's what Barack Obama said. He took his first question from Fox News, an amazing thing, and the question was, "What do you think about Bill Richardson shaving off his beard?" And Barack Obama was like, "You know, we are very upset about this. We liked the beard. We liked that kind of macho guy thing."
And I thought it was a fierce and fearless answer on the part of the president-elect.
There you go. He's taking no crap from Fox News.
No, absolutely not.
Telling it the way it is. Any word from out of what's going on with Mumbai, the whole situation, India, Pakistan, Kashmir, Jammu, et cetera, any fallout in Washington, D.C., any buzz that you're hearing on that?
You can't get any word out of the White House. Dana Perino was asked about that today. She refers everybody to state and basically won't say anything because Condoleezza Rice is over there right now. Condoleezza Rice, in fact, had a press conference herself. So she's spoken to reporters over there, but she is trying to get the Indians and the Pakistanis to not go to war, basically.
Yeah.
And doing her damnedest to do that, and let's hope she succeeds.
She's begging them not to follow the Bush doctrine.
You could say that.
Yes, I just did. I stand by it. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Coming up next, Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research about the middle class.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We're focusing throughout this week on the middle class. We've been kind of gathering data, as it were, the last few days, trying to pull some of the finest minds in this country on this issue onto the program. And tomorrow we'll be debating these issues with Stephen Moore from the Club for Growth and a few other folks, John Berlau from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It should be interesting. Folks that I regularly debate anyway. But I want to set the table here. You know, there's so much going on. There's such a crisis. And here at the very top of today's Financial Times, Nouriel Roubini's article, The Worst is Yet to Come. And he talks about basically we're facing a deflationary crisis, otherwise known as a Great Depression, and that we may, in fact, already be in it. What is the status of the middle class right now? How did the middle class get in the trouble that they are in, and what are the ways to get out of it? Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. The website is CEPR, as in Center for Economic and Policy Research, .net, and has done so much great work in a whole variety of areas, housing, consumer prices, intellectual property, Social Security, Medicare, trade, employment. It's just an all-around genius on all things. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
You recently, I believe you wrote this piece. Was it in the American Prospect? Did you write the piece, Man-Q Promulgates Confusion on the Debt at the New York Times?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. And just this whole idea of debt and trade deficits and deficits versus debt and everything else, how it all plays into the wealth of nations, to use Adam Smith's title. Give us a short course on this.
Well, the issue here is that we're in really an extraordinary time where we've just seen a collapse of demand. People aren't spending money now because they've lost trillions of dollars of wealth in their homes. One of the factors that determines how much people are willing to spend, in terms of buying cars, taking vacations, whatever it might be, is how much wealth they have. And people had $8 trillion more in wealth 2 years ago than what they're looking at now because of the sharp drop in house prices because of the collapse of the housing bubble. So people just stopped spending. And if people don't spend, companies don't have demand, you know, stores don't see demand for their products, the car companies obviously aren't seeing demand for their cars, they lay off workers. So you get this downward spiral. There's no demand, so workers lose their jobs, and obviously if you don't have a job, you don't have an income, then you cut your consumption even more. And that's basically the story that we had in Great Depression, where we just saw a falling off of demand, and the country had high rates of unemployment for a full decade until finally a lot of spending associated with World War II lifted us out of that. But the point, the lesson we've learned, what we know now that we didn't know back in the 30s, was that we don't have to have these periods of prolonged downturns where we have double-digit unemployment. The real key here is simply spending money. And that was the back and forth that I had with Mankiw. Mankiw was saying, well, if we don't spend it right, you know, we should be worried, and it could be really bad if we waste money spending it on bad projects and this and that. So we have to be very careful. And my response was, of course, we want to spend money well. I mean, we want to try to find out where it will be useful. Can we spend money on repairing roads that need to be repaired or bridges so we don't get bridges collapsed? Can we spend money on retrofitting buildings so that we'll need less energy in the future? Can we spend money on educating our kids? Can we spend money on providing health care? All things we might think are really useful and we'd like to have done in any case, but maybe we didn't have the money. Well, not in fact, we have the money and we want to spend it. And I would be the first to say some of it will be wasted. There's no way you could talk about spending hundreds of billions of dollars and not having some of it wasted. But my view, and again, I don't want to put words in Greg Mankiw's mouth. He's a good economist. He knows what he's talking about. But my view is that we shouldn't be worried we're going to waste some of it. We want to try and spend it as well as possible, but it's better to spend it than not spend it. And if some of it's going to be wasted, that's kind of the way it goes. Whereas his view seemed to be more, we have to be very careful. We don't want to waste it because we'll have done these foolish things that really didn't do anyone any good. My view is if we put people to work, we did something good.
Yeah, well, you know, the bottom line, at some point it does have to be paid back. And so there's some consideration there because we're talking now about spending money that is borrowed, not that is taxed.
Well, there's a lot of real confusion on this. It actually doesn't have to get paid back. You have to think about this more carefully, and there's a lot of people have really been trying to perpetuate this confusion in order to cut programs like Social Security and Medicare that they don't like. It really does not have to be paid back. Let's say we borrow, and I'm throwing a number out, but it's probably not a realistic number. Let's say we borrow another $1 trillion over the next 2 years to pay for a stimulus package. Mm-hmm. Well, where does that $1 trillion go? We have people in this country who are going to inherit $1 trillion of bonds. So we get this message all the time, oh, what are we doing to our kids? Well, one of the things we're doing to our kids is we gave them $1 trillion of government bonds. Everything that's paid out in interest goes back to someone else.
Right, but right now about half of the total debt of the U.S. is not held
foreigners.
In the United States.
I'll beat you to the punch on that. Again, they're being dishonest on that. What we borrow from foreigners has nothing to do at the time of the day with our budget deficit. That has to do with our trade deficit. So let's have a conversation about the overvalued dollar. Oh, guess what? None of those people want to have that conversation.
Well, it's also a transfer of wealth out of the United States.
But that's independent of the budget deficit. It's the trade deficit. If we had a budget surplus and we had a trade deficit equal to $700 billion, which is roughly what it is, then that would be the same transfer of wealth. It would just go through a different channel.
Yeah, and
so these people are just being disingenuous. They either don't know what they're talking about or they're trying to mislead people. The transfer of wealth is because of the trade deficit, which is in turn due to an overvalued dollar. It has nothing to do with the budget deficit.
Yeah, well, my point with regard to the transfer of wealth and the trade deficit is perhaps I'm picking nits here, but my point is that when you pay interest, when we pay interest on those treasuries, if we're paying interest to you or to me as bondholders, we're Americans, we're taking that interest, that profit, as it were, on the money that we loaned the government, and we'll spend it in the United States. If we pay that, if we pay that interest instead to somebody in China, that money's not going to end up back in the United States. That money's going to end up building a factory in China.
That's exactly right. But that's
so that is a transfer of wealth outside the United States.
Because of our trade deficit, not because of our budget deficit. So again, let's imagine.
No, I'm saying because of the budget deficit, because they had to borrow.
Because we have a trade deficit, people in China are going to be accumulating assets in the United States. So maybe we're not paying with their tax dollars, but what that means is that they own another, let's say, $1 trillion of corporate America.
Right.
So that the interest and dividends on owning Citigroup, well, Citigroup's probably going to be bankrupt, but whatever companies do still exist in 10 or 15 years, they're going to be paying that money to China rather than people living in the United States. So these are really separate issues. We have a big problem with the trade deficit. That means getting the dollar down. That's independent of the budget deficit.
What is the state of the middle class in America right now, Dean Baker?
Well, it's been deteriorating. It's been deteriorating before this. It's deteriorating even more now. The big problem is that wages haven't been growing. So we've gone through close to 30 years where we've had productivity growth at certain points over, you know, the period 1995 till very recently, very strong productivity growth. But we've had productivity growth over this whole period, which should translate into wage growth. But it hasn't for most workers. All of the benefits of productivity growth, I shouldn't say all, but most of the benefits of productivity growth have either gone to high-end workers, the folks like those who wrecked the economy on Wall Street, high-end workers, doctors and lawyers also have done very well, so professionals have done very well, and it's gone to profits. So most workers have seen very little benefit from wage growth from productivity growth over the last quarter century, and their lives have become much more insecure in many ways. So the risk of losing health care insurance is a much greater risk, both because you're more likely to be without health care insurance, but perhaps even more importantly, it means much more because health care costs so much more today that if you end up being uninsured and you're, say, in the 50s and have some health problems, that's a much more expensive prospect today than it would have been back, say, 25 or 30 years ago. So I would say, you know, middle class has not fared very well over the last quarter century.
If the simple equation is that productivity is, in essence, supply, and wages are, in essence, demand, and historically they've tracked each other, and for the last 30 years, basically, since Reagan declared war on the middle class, productivity has continued to increase, but wages have not. But our purchasing demand, apparent demand, has kept up with supply by virtue of debt rather than wages. Isn't the simple solution to dramatically increase wages, to raise the minimum wage by $6-$8 an hour, for example?
Well, I think we do need a higher minimum wage. I don't know if I'd want to raise it to $6 to $8, and certainly not all at once. But we do have to take a number of steps to get wages back up. Yes, I agree with you. Know, that basically has been the problem, that we haven't seen wage growth keep up with inflation. So keep up with productivity growth. So what that's meant is, as you said, demand's been sustained by borrowing. We were able to do that in the 90s because people borrowed based on the wealth they'd accumulated in the stock market.
And home equity.
And in this decade, home equity, yeah. So that's what sustained the economy.
Yeah, fascinating. Dean Baker, and Dean, the website CEPR.net, right?
That's right.
Okay, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., great guy and brilliant economist. Dean, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, thanks a lot for having me on.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our free live chat room.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
From the news wires, giant retailer Walmart defended itself against possible charges in the death of 34-year-old employee Jutmai Damur, who was trampled to death during a wild stampede last Friday morning at the retailer's Valley Stream, New York store. Mr. Damur's demise, while regrettable, was not the fault of Walmart, said Harry Cohen, a lawyer with the Goldberg, Leventhal, Popovich and Stump law firm. First, Mr. Damur worked only 37.5 hours a week, which does not qualify him under the law to a safe working place. And second, since all of Walmart's merchandise is manufactured in China, Mr. Damur is afforded only the protections of the typical Chinese worker, and we all know what that is. Besides, Mr. Damur assumed the risk by getting between a herd of hysterical shoppers and a rack of super bargains that only Walmart can offer. Actually, it's not the news. It's from PTSD1.blogspot.com, the Post-Times Sun Dispatch. And it goes on from there. It gets weirder and weirder, but a little levity in the news. Frank in Los Angeles. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today? Thanks for calling in.
The vast conspiracy. I don't know if you believe in conspiracy theories of making a two-class society, the poor and the rich, just like they did 2,000 years ago. You know, this doesn't all come about as a big surprise to me because Ronald Reagan resurrected Calvin Coolidge's trickle-down theory, and Bush, brought it to the peak. He didn't have more time to depress the middle class down to the poverty level, but he added, I think it was 20 million people in addition to the 40 that Ronald Reagan added to the population.
Frank, let me turn your theory upside down, if I may.
Sure.
While I agree with you, okay? I would submit to you that what these guys are doing is not a conspiracy for two reasons. Number one, they're doing it right out in the open.
Yeah, that's true, too.
And number two, a middle class is not a normal thing. This is the number one thing Americans have to learn. It's the core focus of the first third of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. You know, explaining.
But I don't understand what you mean by the middle class is not a normal thing. Why can't it be, or why shouldn't it be, and why isn't it?
It's not because of what is referred to as David Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages. In 1816, David Ricardo wrote two papers that are well worth reading today. One was called On Profits, the other was called On Labor. And in those, he pointed out a truth that goes back 7,000 years, which is that when the supply of labor equals the demand for labor, the cost of labor, in other words, what people are paid, the cost of labor will fall to that of what Ricardo referred to as a subsistence level. In other words, enough to just get by.
Yeah, but that's the game they play.
It's not the game. Just let me finish the thought here real quickly, and then you see if you can take it apart. The
sure.
point is that the world that Charles Dickens described, the world of Bob Cratchit, you know, please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal for my hands? They're warm. You know, they're freezing. No, you may not. Scrooge was the middle class. He was a small businessman with only one employee. The world of Dickens, who knew this well because his own father was thrown in debtor's prison, Charles Dickens, that world had a very small wealthy class, a very small middle class, people like Scrooge, you know, the few shop owners, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, and 95, 96, 97% of everybody else was the working poor. That is what an unrestrained capitalist laissez-faire economy will always produce. 100% of the time, you go back to ancient Sumeria 7,000 years ago under Gilgamesh, you go back to 5,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago to the Greek times, you go back 2,000 years ago to the Roman Empire, you go back throughout the history of Europe. The only thing, there's only two ways to create a middle class. And they both require a conspiracy. See, this is a conspiracy on our part. They require imposing artificial conditions. The first way is to reduce, actually there's three ways. The first way is to reduce the quantity of labor. If you reduce the number of laborers, then the price of labor will go up because there's not enough people to work. That's what happened after the Black Death in the 1300s or the 1400s, which led to the Renaissance. And that's what happened. So, you know, obviously we don't want a third of all the workers to die off, but that's one way to create a middle class. The second way is to increase massively the wealth base. And that's what happened for the Enlightenment in the 1600s and also happened in North America. And that is where, you know, they basically, the Europeans plundered and pillaged all the gold out of Central and South America and the slave labor. And we took all this land from the Indians. And that produced so much wealth that the wealth relative to the amount of labor drove up the price of labor and produced a middle class. But from the 1830s, until the 1930s, there was functionally no middle class in the United States outside of the family farmer. There was very little middle class because we had gone back to the norm. And Franklin Roosevelt came along and said the third way, number one, we're not going to kill off a third of the population. Number two, we don't have any more countries to rob, rape, and pillage. And so the third way to do it is to tax the rich and spread that wealth around, to paraphrase Barack Obama. And that's what he did, and it created a middle class. And Reagan's been undoing that. So if we want to have a middle class, we have to create it intentionally because it's not a normal thing.
Well, the thing is this. The game is that to make people beg for that job, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And see, that's the normal thing, is people begging for the job, and that's why we have to realize, and thank you very much for the call, Frank, because it's very well said, and you set me up perfectly, that a middle class is not a normal thing. You have to work at it, and that's the job we have to do now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Yeah, I want to just shout out to the folks over at democraticunderground.com. There's some great top five threads, some really thought-provoking ones there. Well, you know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes, as the Fireside Theater reminds us, everything you know is wrong. I think. Do we have it? I'm not hearing it. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had the clip, Stephanie. So for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment today, Mary T. Brown is with us, Wall Street's psychic advisor, author of The Five Rules of Thought. Her website, Mary T. Brown with an E at the end, marytbrown.com. And she's the author of Love in Action, Life After Death, The Power of Karma. Her most recent book, The Five Rules of Thought, her fourth book, lives in Manhattan. Mary, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us. And I find in your – first of all, I want to say, most of the major decisions in my life, I've thrown the I Ching over.
Okay. I love and it's just as good as any other way to do it, right?
Yeah, it seems, you know. It's – yeah, and you know, there's sort of a gut check. I always like – go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but you're not being facetious. You probably really do, right?
I really do, yeah.
Okay.
And
I want your listeners to know we're not kidding. That
no,
you do.
No, I'm quite serious. And the gut check part of it is what you could call the oh crap test. We use a word that you can't use on the radio, actually, but there's a dimension of that, and that is I've learned over the years one easy, quick way to access my own unconscious mind is to say, we'll take an insignificant decision. Am I going to have Indian food or Chinese food tonight?
Uh-huh.
And I'll flip and I'll take a coin and I'll say, okay, heads Indian, tails Chinese. Flip the coin, and then when I look at it, one of two thoughts immediately goes through my mind: oh boy, or oh crap. And then I know what I really wanted, right?
Oh,
and
there you go.
And throwing the I Ching kind of in a more subtle and richer textured way revalidates that. But your point is that some of the most famous, successful people on Wall Street over the years, because you're the advisor to Wall Street, the psychic advisor to Wall Street.
Which, in a way, I don't know, Tom, if it sounds like such a good thing this week. But
yeah.
I just want to say my clients have jobs.
There you
so
go.
I'm not, you know, I don't want your listeners to say, oh, I just sit on some, you know, podium like the Oracles at Delphi and just advise the whole mess.
No, but Andrew Carnegie
and
J.P. Morgan.
My clients have jobs. And,
right.
And so, yes, I have... I was advising them to get out and, you know, to sell and to do things a little different about a year ago. But
well, that's very wise of you. And
yes,
J.P. Morgan and Carnegie, yep, and others use people
them.
Like you. Yeah. But
President
you're,
Lincoln,
you're,
real people.
You're absolutely right. And Eleanor Roosevelt, famous for this. One of the things, though, that I wanted to talk to you about, your book, your new book, The Five Rules of Thought, in my humble opinion, and is a really well done, really nice modern day revisiting of Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, Dale Carnegie's.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Come to think of it, I had not really read Napoleon Hill's book before I wrote mine, but I did see it after.
Uh-huh.
And I think, thank you, that's a great compliment. I think that about 100, I heard you speaking right before I came on, and you were talking about the 1600s, and, you know, then you talked about when the land was stolen from the Indians, and then you talked about historic things. Well, historically, 100 years ago, there was a thought movement, Tom. It was
yes.
Napoleon.
The new
Hill.
Thought movement.
Yeah, the New Thought movement. So it's things seem to take cycles, right? So now again, people are magnetizing toward understanding.
Yeah, and it's still around, by the way, Mary. I was the keynote speaker at the Association for Global New Thoughts annual conference in Palm Springs just a month ago.
Okay.
So,
we're singing the same tune.
There you go. So what I'd like you to tell my listeners, we're talking with Mary T. Brown, Brown with an E at the end. MaryTBrown.com is her website. And you know, your five rules for thought, this is like really actually great stuff, you know, just like Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, particularly for financial hard times.
Definitely.
How to actually be successful, how to reprogram your conscious and unconscious brain to be successful. Your turn, Mary. Go for it.
Oh, no, Tom. It's just that for my whole life, I've been thinking about thought. I've used the five rules of thought myself. Thousands of my clients have used it, and I tried to just give people a prescription for learning how to use thought. Nobody's taught anybody. People do not know how to focus on one thing and one thing alone in order to get the results that they want. It's kind of like the Salvation Army was successful because somebody thought, let's give away donuts, right? That was a thought that might have sounded silly, but it brought people to the place to give them, you know, the success they had. So people have to learn how to know what they want. They have to learn how to see it done. If you can see something done, you can get to it much, much quicker.
It's visualizing.
So you but visualizing in a different way. We visualize all the time. If you fall in love with somebody, you think about, oh, my gosh, what were they wearing? What did they say to me? Oh, how fabulous. We visualize. And we have to learn how to do that in a way that it creates a magnetic force around the thought. And so I don't just throw the rules at people, Tom. Mm-hmm. I teach them how to do it.
Yep.
People have to learn not to vacillate. Because on one, you know, it's like you say, flipping the coin with the Chinese or the Indian food, you know, it's like one side you win, one side you lose. So people lose faith, they start to vacillate, and they cave. This is the time in the history of the world when people need to keep their thought firm, focused, and be able to follow the rules so we can get through this crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But thought is the most powerful force in the universe.
Yeah, if you look around, I mean, I'm here in New York City this week, and you look around, and literally everything I see, because there's not much nature here, everything I see started out as a thought in somebody's mind.
Everything.
Yeah.
Right? A picture, a canvas is started as a thought in the mind of the artist. The book that I wrote, it started out as a thought. Radio show, I mean, vocal, you know, music is thinking with a tune, and radio are sound waves that travel similar to thought waves.
Yep. Buildings and every building started with somebody saying, hey, I think I'll build a building there.
And usually architects, clients of mine who are architects will say, I don't know, I just saw this picture in my mind of this building I wanted to do. And then I went to my desk and I started drawing it.
Yeah.
Or my really successful clients always say, I don't know how, Mary, I just knew when I was a kid that I was going to have this boating business, or I was just walking down the street one day and I thought, oh, bubblegum, or some, you know, thing that may sound wacky, but it starts with these kind of thoughts. But really, really successful people know how to use thought. They know how to use it, focus it. They know how to not waste it. They know how to send it out to the right, in the right thought waves being picked up by similar thinking people. They don't become mediums for other people's thoughts.
Right. We're talking with Mary T. Brown. Mary T. Brown with an E on the end, .com is her website. She's the author of her most recent book, The Five Rules of Thought. Mary, I read Napoleon Hill's book when I was 19 years old. I took a Dale Carnegie course when I was 20, and they literally changed my life. Napoleon Hill's core concept was, you visualize something, and at the same time, you bring up as much emotional intensity as you can, and you link the two together so that that visualization has an emotional intensity that draws you then inevitably towards it. It sounds to me like that's essentially what you're saying.
Absolutely, yes, and absolutely, and almost exactly that, but maybe in even a less detailed way. But I also give, you know, case histories. It's about magnetism, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
It's about energy around a thought. And if you can feel something before it happens, you know, Winston Churchill, I was reading his biographies, and he talked about that, which would make sense, that he could always feel something done way before it was done, and that always made it happen 100 times faster. And he used to say to people, why do you always have to wait to feel good until something happens?
Yeah.
And we know he would go into his dark mood, so he would know the opposite of that as well.
Sure.
But when he was feeling good or feeling excited, he knew that somehow that brought the what he wanted into form faster. So if you can go to sleep at night feeling that you have the job, feeling that your, you know, romantic life is in order, just the way you feel, that happy kind of feeling, it works on your subconscious.
Yeah.
And so when you wake up and you start thinking and clearly, you know, focusing your mind and learning the rules of thought, it works, which people consider magic. You know, they get kind of spooked because they can't believe the power of thought, because it really is that extraordinary.
Thought
is the one thing that doesn't cost money in a bad economy, too.
Yeah. I would say the two most powerful forces in the world are thought and love, and probably in the reverse order, although you could argue that one is a subset of the other.
That's right. And that's true. And when you're always thinking of love, you can't make a mistake. When you're thinking a loving thought, when you're thinking that so I talk about what people's auras look like, Tom. You know, it's amazing. You know, when people are thinking one thing and saying another thing, how that just kind of causes nothing but their life to go retrograde all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, feeling also and thought also has a color. You exude a color, and love has, you know, it sounds kind of silly, think pink, but it does. It has this gorgeous mauve pink color. So, you know, simplest thing for anybody that's in a terrible problem or they don't know what words to use to help somebody, think pink. Just see the color and send it out on the planet, because everybody needs as much love as they can get right
now.
And
I'm telling you, people on Wall Street pay Mary T. Brown $400 an hour for this advice, and it is well taken. Mary
Thank
T.
You.
Brown with an E at the end, brownbrownwe.com. Thank you, Mary, for being
Thank
with us today.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Great talking with you. Her new book, The Five Rules of Thought, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
So in the chat room, Benedict says, Tom actually has a sophisticated decision support methodology. Shock! Sometimes it's not as sophisticated as it should be. And Sue says, are there any books for those of us who can't visualize or feel things? And that's interesting. So, by the way, tomorrow, just a heads up, we may be a little distracted as we're doing the show tomorrow, because ABC News is sending over a film crew who will be in the studio shooting us. And then tomorrow night, I'll be over at the ABC studios hanging out with John Stossel. I don't know if it's going to make it on the air, this, you know, or what's going to happen from it. But, hey, I'm looking forward to it. I disagree with John on a lot of things, but I have a lot of respect for him. So we'll see where that goes, and it should be interesting. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And let's see here, Jack in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was listening to your radio station earlier, talking about, you know, things that we have to do to spend our way out of this economy. And the fellow was saying that, you know, usually it doesn't matter too much what you spend it on, but, you know, but it would be nice at the same time to spend it on some pretty good ideas. You know, going back to sort of the Roosevelt WPA type project and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to just raise one specific subject, and that's nuclear power plants. And I know that in the campaign, McCain was saying, hey, let's fast track 45 nuclear power plants. You know, and you know, Senator Obama was saying, well, we'll look at nuclear plants, but as long as the storage and the operation of these plants are successful, which I kind of took as, you know, let's not do this.
Right.
But I wonder why so many people object, mostly the progressives, object to nuclear power. And what a beautiful thing this would be for global warming.
And let me give you a couple of arguments against nuclear power then. Number one, there is a limited amount of uranium in the world. It's much like oil. In fact, we may have hit peak uranium. Oddly, Iran has huge uranium reserves, which is one of the reasons why they're trying to build nuclear power plants there. But there are large chunks of the world where there's not a whole lot of uranium, and it's a limited resource. Number two, mining that uranium uses enormous amounts of fossil fuel and produces greenhouse gases and produces waste, which is radioactive and contaminates communities, water, stream, air. Transporting that uranium uses fossil fuels. Refining that uranium, I mean, look at Iran now for an entire year has been running centrifuges with electricity generated by oil to purify the uranium down to up to the 3.5% purification where they can put it in a reactor. All of these steps use enormous amounts of fossil fuel. Mining in particular is no small operation. And so by the time you get the uranium to the nuclear power plant, you've already invested in it so much fossil fuel that according to Helen Caldicott's math, and she's pretty good at this, she's been doing it most of her life, a nuclear power plant produces its first watt of actual electricity from uranium as opposed to all of the oil that was invested in that uranium somewhere between its 15th and 17th year of operation. So, number one, nuclear power plants are not a great way to end fossil fuels because they're so fossil fuel intensive to get them up and running. Then number two, you've got a limited resource that is becoming more and more expensive over time. Look at uranium futures right now. And number three, when you're all done, you've got 30 years worth of electricity that you can produce, arguably 50 if you really stretch it out, 30 to 50 years worth of electricity that you can produce from this facility. And what's left over is something that is going to be deadly, so deadly. One ounce of plutonium, if it were evenly distributed all across the Earth, would be enough to kill every human being on Earth. This is incredibly toxic stuff, and it is going to be toxic for 250,000 years. If the pharaohs of Egypt, when they built the pyramid at Giza, if that pyramid had been a nuclear power plant, they would have gotten 30 years worth of cheap electricity. And now, 5,000 years later, we would still only be about 10%. We'd be about 1% into the time period that we would have to be guarding that thing, keeping people away from it so they don't get killed or damaged by it. That does not seem to me like a rational energy policy.
Well, I'd like to respond to some of these items you said. First of all, the limited supply, there's probably, I'd heard estimates 100 or 200 years of supply of it. And
at current rate of consumption, but that's, it's supplying less than 2% of the world's electricity. So if you start.
We can talk about that in a minute, but there are, I didn't want to go into the breeder reactor idea, but you can actually take non-radioactive uranium and enrich and actually turn it into the radioactive version of it using breeder reactors.
Yeah, the French are doing it.
And try to make more fuel, and believe it or not, make more fuel than you actually consume in doing so, because they use spent neutrons to activate the uranium.
I understand the concept. Yeah, the problem is, though, that the containers end up toxic. You've got toxic waste there.
Okay. Now, we're facing a heck of a problem. We've got 6 billion people on the Earth, and global warming is a problem. I thoroughly agree that global warming is a problem, not so much for the atmosphere, for the oceans. It's turning the oceans. You can measure it. It's the pH is actually going down. The ocean's becoming more acidic. And, in time, that's going to cause some real problems with, releasing some noxious gases out of the ocean into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So there are, global warming.
But Jack, the show's over. I'm sorry. We're just out of time. It's a topic that deserves a longer discussion and a thoughtful one. And I appreciate your being thoughtful with me about it. But let me just leave you with this one point. In 1 hour, the amount of sunlight that falls on capturable surfaces on the planet Earth is enough to generate all of the electricity used by the entire planet in 1 year. So I think there are alternatives. Tomorrow, John Berlow of the Competitive Enterprise Institute says deregulation is the answer to saving the middle class, and Stephen Moore, the Club of Growth, says, taxes? No, you don't want to do that. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.